From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike Scott.
I'm basically what they call a lab rat.
Marie Loughran loves being at a research bench.
Hands-on. You know, if I wasn't a chemist, I'd be a cook.
For over a decade, Loughran worked happily at one of Merck's campuses in suburban Philadelphia. Then last fall, rumors surfaced of possible layoffs.
Work pretty much came to a standstill.
Anxiety set in.
And then the big day came, and I got the little blue folder slid over to me from the director of our department, and I was devastated.
Loughran's story echoes throughout our region. Thousands of pharma jobs have been cut.
There's a lot of people looking for work. It's quite competitive.
On today's show, displaced pharma workers adjusting, trying to get back to what they love to do.
That's the hardest part, not being able to do science.
Also on the show, can mushrooms save the world? First, the news. Big Pharma has taken a big hit, displacing thousands of employees.
Tossed to the wind.
Eliminated.
Disaster.
Devastated.
So, what's next?
These individuals did not want to hang it up.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse steps into Broadway dressing rooms and makes phone calls to the bottom of the ocean to really understand the latest research and science.
Into the surgery, their year interned, Kelly Green.
There's about 2 to 3 million people in the United States known to be living with epilepsy.
Itchy eyes, sneezing, runny nose.
Often it runs in families.
Circuit boards. Using soybeans and chicken feathers.
They're nice and shiny, kind of pearly white.
Other people approaching them and commenting on how they look or telling them to.
I generally dislike buzzwords.
You don't use honey on your face?
It was felt to be related to hysteria.
They didn't want to accept the fact that you were on the same level.
On today's show, dude, what's in your beer? Or rather, understanding the science of fermentation. And we meet a brand new element, perhaps soon to grace the periodic table. But first up, back to the displaced pharma workers. This region is a hub for the pharmaceutical industry. Some of the drugs that have transformed medicine have been developed right here. Think vaccines and medicine for heart disease and diabetes. But the industry is changing. We've seen a lot of consolidations and downsizing of these big companies, leaving thousands of smart people out of work, facing challenges and, in some instances, unexpected opportunities. Alana Gordon reports.
The room is upbeat, friendly.
Perfect. Feel free to sign in, take a card.
About 2 dozen people, mostly women, filter into a lecture space at DeVry University. It's in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. But the people here aren't students. Lisa Koshia says the combined expertise filling these seats could run a multi-billion dollar drug company.
We have CEOs, we have MDs, PhDs, we have, you know, sales and marketing, we have nurses, we have research scientists, I mean, you name it, we have it.
Everyone, including Koshia, is here because they're in some way out of work, or as they put it, in transition.
And everybody would say to me, oh, you know what, don't worry about it, you'll get a job tomorrow, you're so talented, with all your skill set, oh, no worries. And I'm finding that it's been the exact opposite.
Most people here don't want to put their name on tape when I talk to them. As big as the pharma sector may seem, they tell me it's actually a very, very small world.
I may be like blacklisted in the industry, and I don't want that.
People share a mix of experiences and emotions. There's the disbelief, frustration, and stress in some cases about the next mortgage payment.
Okay, well, welcome everybody. I'm so glad you could enjoy and come to our program, Reinventing Your Career and Expanding Your Options.
Koshia is the current co-chair of this bi-weekly group. It's mainly for women, though they recently opened it up to men because of the strong interest. Everyone introduces themselves, and then John Brady steps to the front.
Whenever we're going through,
he's a career coach the group invited in to give advice. He pulls up a PowerPoint, walks back and forth as he talks, and at one point cues up a scene from Rocky for a bit of inspiration.
Now, if you know what you're worth, now go out and get what you're worth. But you got to be willing to take the hits and not pointing fingers saying you ain't where you want to be because of him or her or anybody. Cowards do that, and that ain't you. You're better than that.
You know, one of those better silver screen moments that I like to throw in there. Believing in yourself and keep moving forward. Anyway, so getting into the networking piece of this.
Over the next hour and a half, Brady talks about working through that initial trauma of a job loss and how to be more successful in finding a new job. Everyone's paying attention. Some take notes like students.
One of the problems with the way I think we're all taught to do networking.
There have been anywhere from 4,000 to 6,000 so-called displaced PhDs in this region as a result of the recent restructuring and downsizing in the pharma industry. That's according to an area economic development agency. And it means a lot of people may be out there trying to figure out the next step. There have been several waves. Bill Kinney, an organic chemist for 25 years, was laid off from Johnson & Johnson in 2009.
When people lose their jobs, they're not just losing their job, their income, they're losing their scientific family.
Kinney of Bucks County says his career path since has been a fluid one. He first did consulting, as many do. Business dried up after a year. Finally, he said he just had to do something.
So I said, oh, let me just go down the street and work for my neighbor who has this landscaping business. And he didn't know I was a PhD chemist. He just thought I was a desperate guy needing a job. But it actually was therapeutic to get out there watering plants, driving around, delivering plants for weddings, and driving a truck and just working again.
Today, Kinney has been working to get back to his love of drug discovery and development. He still does consulting, but spends most of his time on the business side of a nonprofit research institute. They're mining for drugs in a collection of tens of thousands of plant samples donated by Merck.
I think in the current pharmaceutical climate, everybody's looking to discover a drug very quickly. So they have a target of interest, and within 2 years, they want to have a drug that's going into man. Natural products takes longer.
Kinney is based out of the Pennsylvania Biotech Center in Doylestown. It's a simple beige building, quite the opposite of the chic glass buildings sprawled across tree-lined college-esque campuses that are characteristic of many big pharma sites. But inside, one can find what Kinney describes as a snapshot of the evolution of pharma, its business model, and drug pipeline. It's here where research and ideas from scientists, venture capitalists, academics, many laid off from big pharma, all mixed together. There's Ren Capicassel, who was laid off in 2008.
It truly was an opportunity coming out of what that day seemed like a disaster when I was laid off.
Capicassel admits to being sort of a poster guy for the growing field of contract research organizations. He started a company when he was on the way out of Johnson & Johnson. His company offers needed services along different parts of the drug development process.
What happens are cells get driven through a series of tubes.
Capicassel shows me an expensive machine the size of a mini fridge that runs sophisticated screenings on cell samples. He contracts with big drug companies that don't want to do those things in-house anymore, or for little ones that don't have the capacity on their own. Then there's Marie Lochran. She stands over a counter mixing compounds in a nearby lab.
It's where I do all my reactions and synthesis for small molecules.
Lochran is not at the PhD level, but she loves being at the bench, helping to develop potentially life-saving drugs. 6 months ago, she lost her job at Merck, as did most other mid-level chemists in her lab.
I was devastated. You know, like, that was my life.
Through a work contact, she met with the head of a small business founded by, you guessed it, a laid-off pharma scientist. The business does a mix of academic collaborations and its own early research with hopes a big company may one day pick it up. She started there earlier this year.
I think I was one of the lucky few.
Then there's Kumar Shaluhai.
I can tell you, I've been in big pharma for the last 20, 25 years. There are many people like me who have ideas, but they don't find home. So the ideas die.
Shaluhai voluntarily left a secure job several years ago to develop his own therapy. His previous company wasn't interested. Sometimes places don't want to take the financial risk, or a drug just isn't in its strategic research plan. So he started from scratch, courting investors over a decade ago. Today, Shaluhai tells me he's feeling really good about a recent clinical trial. But in general, the chances of a drug in the clinical phase making it to market is about 1 in 10. Shaluhai tells me poor results would kill his company, but he's willing to take the risk.
For me, as a scientist, discovering a technology and taking it all the way up to market is not only financially, but personal reward as well. And down the road, I would be able to tell my children or grandchildren that I brought this drug to the market, and it's helping so many people.
But are there times when you've been worried that, like, oh, maybe, you know, we're not getting the results, that the promising results? Like, I mean, what were to happen if that went in that direction?
To put it simply, in the last 16 years, I haven't slept well. It goes on every day, every day. It's a day-to-day event.
It's in this small place that Kinney and others say they've been able to find support and begin to reestablish that scientific community they've longed for since getting laid off. It's certainly not big enough to absorb everyone out there, but they hope it can be an example.
That's it. Thank you for coming. Thank you to our speaker, John.
Thanks.
Back in King of Prussia, the career coach presentation wraps up after about 2 hours. Afterwards, Lisa Kochia, the co-chair of the group who's worked in pharma sales for over 20 years, tells me today's session was really helpful in getting her to think about positions she hadn't considered before. She says being involved in this group, supporting others, helps her stay optimistic.
I'm a true believer that everything happens for a reason, and there's a plan that's higher than myself. So I'm a big believer that something will come and the next great opportunity is there to be found.
She's keeping an open mind, and who knows, if one of those scientists at PA Biotech or elsewhere were to find a promising drug, there's plenty of talent, including herself, in this region, ready to put it to market. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Who is sending inflated medical bills to the government? A brand new data analysis of Medicare billing patterns offers some clues. Tanya English spoke with the lead reporter on this investigation.
Charlie Ornstein is senior reporter with the news outlet ProPublica, which specializes in investigative reporting. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tanya, for having me.
Your new report provides tools for tracking how doctors and other healthcare providers bill Medicare. So the thought is that if the government did a better job of analyzing the data, that's a way to kind of root out fraud and abuse. So what can you tell from the way that a doctor charges for office visits?
It's sort of interesting to look and see how much money a doctor earns from Medicare in the course of a given year. But for me, as a patient and somebody helping relatives choose their doctors, I think it's far more interesting to look at whether or not these doctors practice medicine in a way that's responsible, in a way that's like their peers, or if they're choosing services and tests and procedures that others are not choosing. And if they are, I'd want to know why that is.
What are some of the medically reasonable reasons that a doctor might look like an outlier compared to other physicians or healthcare providers?
Some do indeed treat more complex patients. Some work in impoverished communities with people who have greater health problems. And some have more experience in the field and receive referrals from other doctors for complicated health conditions. But that said, I think if you talk to most doctors, many will tell you that their patients are sicker than other doctors. But not every doctor can have sicker patients than every other doctor.
I think there's a term that we're going to hear a lot around your report called upcoding. Can you define that for us?
Sure. Upcoding is when a doctor will bill for a certain procedure that they didn't necessarily deliver. So they will bill at a higher level than the service that they performed.
So the cost of analyzing big data sets has gotten less expensive, but do we know if the government spends more, if they shine a brighter light, look more closely at billing patterns? Is that a good way to spend money?
Well, Medicare has been criticized for years for not using its own data. One of the questions that we've raised is we're finding doctors who are sort of extreme outliers, so look very, very different from their peers. And we talk to them and they say Medicare has never contacted them. If taxpayers are spending hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars on a single provider whose patterns are unusual, is there the right tools and the right staff and the right sort of priorities there to identify those folks and ask them some questions?
So you've created an online tool that lets consumers look up their own doctor and find out about his or her billing practices. If I log on, what can I learn?
When you go to our treatment tracker, I think one of the things you're going to find is information that helps put your doctor in context. We're trying to help you understand, is your doctor providing more services per patient than other doctors in that same specialty.
So putting money aside, can billing patterns be maybe an indicator that you're being overtreated or a worry about the quality of the care that you're getting?
Overtreatment is a huge concern, and I think generally patients think the more healthcare, the better, but a lot of research has shown that that's just not the case, that you don't necessarily want to get every test and every treatment and every procedure. There are risks associated with those too.
So if I discover that my doctor is practicing differently than his peers, what's my next step?
Patients within a year or two are going to have so much in the way of tools at their disposal to help evaluate their doctors and to help them make decisions. And that's what's really exciting about this. And it's also scary. You're now going to actually have some empirical data to help you determine if the doctor you're going to is similar to others. And if not, then you're faced with choices on whether or not you want to switch doctors.
Charles Orenstein is a senior reporter with ProPublica, and you can find a link to the new online tool, Treatment Tracker, on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. And he spoke with reporter Tanya English. Coming up on The Pulse, putting the brakes on wasting energy.
That takes the forward momentum of the entire train, converts it back into electricity, and that in turn is reintroduced back into the power grid.
That's next on The Pulse.
Dreams moan in my sleep when I'm trying to go to bed. Moving way too slow for whatever to carry.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Train, train, train. I've got a thing about trains.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Amtrak's locomotive fleet is about 35 years old, and collectively, those engines have between 3 and 4 million miles on them. Tired little engines, indeed, and very expensive to keep running. But Amtrak is upgrading and investing in a fleet of brand new high-tech train engines that save energy. The AC64 City Sprinter was unveiled back in February and will continue to roll out over the coming months. Pulse contributor Sophie Reed climbed aboard to take a look.
America's national railroad operator has unveiled five gleaming new AC64 City Sprinter engines. The sixth of these impressive electric engines goes into service this week. The Siemens-made locomotives have been brought in to replace Amtrak's entire fleet of existing engines on the Northeast Regional Corridor. So from Washington, D.C. to Boston, via Wilmington, Philadelphia, and New York. They'll also operate on the Keystone service between New York, Philadelphia, and Harrisburg. Greg Gagarin is an Amtrak engineer and one of the executives overseeing the AC64 project. He took me on board at Amtrak's Wilmington maintenance facility for a rare glimpse.
We're in one of the two cabs in the locomotive. Here you can see, Sophie, the different displays. Here is the throttle. This is the brake control here. And then we have a number of obvious switches and buttons for the various controls on the locomotive, the lighting, the headlights, the horn, the bell. These displays are intended to give the engineer information as to how his vehicle or locomotive is performing, as well as the status of various subsystems on the engine.
The first of 70 brand new City Sprinters hit the tracks back in February. They're part of the biggest purchase of electric trains since World War II. Gagarin explains what's special scientifically about these whiz-bang locomotives.
The engine has a feature known as regenerative braking. That takes the forward momentum of the entire train, converts it back into electricity, And that, in turn, is reintroduced back into the power grid.
Back inside Amtrak's Wilmington offices, Greg Gagarin told me that innovations like the energy saving brakes will make their trains greener and save money, around $300 billion over the next 20 years. He gave us a science lesson on how the brakes create energy.
You can, with a very simple switch now run by a computer, turn those motors into generators, alternators specifically. And the alternators will generate the exact same electrical power that they were consuming.
That power is then sent back through the engine's propulsion machinery into a device called the pantograph, which collects the power. And that will allow for big energy savings.
Well, the estimate of 3 billion kilowatt hours is probably an order of magnitude in terms of the energy savings that is anticipated to be saved.
That's enough to power over 250,000 American homes, or an awful lot of light bulbs. Amtrak isn't the only one using this clever technology. Philadelphia's mass transit system, SEPTA, adopted regenerative braking on its trains in 2012. SEPTA captures the energy generated by its train's brakes at 30 substations. It's then stored and put back into the grid. Just one substation in Kensington, Philadelphia, is thought to be saving SEPTA around $60,000 a year in electricity bills and creating $200,000 in revenue. Back at Siemens, they also threw in some new safety features. Gagarin says the Amtrak City Sprinter's crash technology is like that of a race car.
The race cars are intended to fall apart in a very specific way, and that the shell that surrounds the driver is almost always intact at the end of one of these very dramatic collisions that you often see in racing.
Green improvements and more safety. Fantastic. But you're probably wondering, will the new engines go any faster than the current ones? Could they rush you from New York City to Philadelphia in, say, 45 minutes? The answer to that is no. The City Sprinter's top speeds of 125 miles per hour are no quicker than Amtrak's existing fleet can muster. In comparison, Germany's ICE trains travel at over 170 miles per hour, and French TGV locomotives top 200 miles per hour. Britain is building a high-speed rail network that will allow speeds of 250 miles per hour. But Gagarin says America has a different approach.
Because of some of the accidents that have historically occurred on railroads in North America, there was a focus as well on the survivability of the trains. And of course, that does make them bulkier and heavier.
And what about Amtrak's old outgoing engines? They'll gradually be replaced, with plans for the last to be retired next year. Eventually, they'll be sold off to another railroad or scrapped. For The Pulse, I'm Sophie Reed.
If the popular TV series Breaking Bad were to be resurrected, you know, maybe with an update on Jesse Pinkman or something, the producers could have a new option for those periodic table-inspired opening credits. Scientists have created a new element, and a very heavy one at that. Joining us now to explain this is Clara Moskowitz. She's an associate editor with Scientific American. Hi, Clara.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What is Element 117?
Element 117 is a brand new element on the periodic table that we've never seen before. We haven't ever found it in nature, but scientists just created it inside a laboratory. And an element is defined by how many protons are inside the atom, inside its nucleus. And this one has 117 protons, which is pretty huge. It's the second largest element we've ever found.
How did physicists create this new element, 117?
So to create 117, they needed to take two ingredients that had the right number of protons to add up to 117. And they started with calcium, which has 20 protons inside of its nucleus, and an element called berkelium, which has 97. Berkelium itself is not easily found. You can't just buy it off the shelf. So Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee actually had to spend 2 years making a large enough sample of berkelium to use in this experiment. Once they had the berkelium,
they accelerated the calcium nuclei fast enough so that they were going about 10% the speed of light, and then they slammed them together. And the idea is, if two nuclei are slamming into each other with enough force, with enough speed, occasionally two of them will hit head-on and they'll stick together to form a brand new element with the combined number of protons.
And why do physicists want to create these heavy, heavy elements?
Partly it's for the thrill of discovery, of making something brand new that's never been seen before, because when they create these elements, they are curious about their properties and how they act differently compared to all of the other known elements. And also, there's this fabled island of stability on the periodic table. It's just an idea. It's not proven, but they believe that there might be an area on the periodic table that exists where really heavy elements become stable and live for a really long time.
Now, explain that concept. Is it that the heavier the element gets, the less stable it is?
That's right. So remember in high school chemistry class, we probably learned that protons have a positive charge. And inside a nucleus, there's protons and neutrons. The neutrons are neutral. But the protons are repelling against each other because two positive charges repel. Mm-hmm. So the more protons you pack into a nucleus, the more repellent force there is trying to break it apart. And nature just doesn't like a large nucleus, it seems.
What is the heaviest element that we can find in nature?
Uranium is the heaviest one that's found in large enough quantities. Anything past that is usually artificial or usually created in the laboratory. And what's really interesting is that they don't know for sure if these really heavy elements don't exist in nature or if we just haven't seen them yet. And there are a lot of searches underway right now looking for really trace small amounts of these super heavy elements that might exist here on Earth, just underneath our noses.
So what happens to these heavy elements in nature? Do they break apart quickly?
They do. So uranium, as we all know, is radioactive, meaning that it decays into smaller elements over time. It doesn't stay stable. And we measure how long an element lasts on average by its half-life, meaning half of it will be gone after this amount of time. And element 117, for example, has a tiny, tiny half-life. It lasted on average only 50 milliseconds before disappearing.
And how does this brand new element now relate to this concept of island of stability that you explained earlier?
Right. So scientists hope that they're getting closer with this element. They don't know where this island might be or exactly how many protons it would take to reach this new level of stability and long life. But they saw a few signs in this process with element 117 that are very hopeful. For example, when element 117 decays, it breaks down into smaller elements. And one of them was something called lawrencium. It has 103 protons in its nucleus. But they saw a version of lawrencium that's never, ever been seen. And this version actually lasted for 11 hours. It had a half-life of 11 hours, which is an incredibly long time for these very heavy elements. And the fact that it lasted so long suggests to the scientists that they might be getting close to the island of stability.
Thank you so much for joining us and for explaining this to us.
Thanks for having me.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron.
Clara Moskowitz is an associate editor with Scientific American. H2O coming straight from your tap might contain some unwanted elements. Drugs prescribed to your neighbors, your fellow citizens, their pets. Scientists have known this for a long time, and they know how these drugs get there. Don't panic, though. The research is clear. Nobody is getting a full accidental dose of, let's say, Prozac, for example, just from drinking tap water. Still, scientists do wonder whether drugs in the water may be harming aquatic life or complicating the growing problem of drug-resistant bacteria. Katie Collinari has this story.
These aren't your typical sprinklers. We're at the Living Filter up in State College, Pennsylvania, where wastewater from the university's treatment plant is being sprayed onto a grove of trees. Penn State graduate student Allison Franklin fills up a large amber-colored jar with water from one of the spray heads. Later, she'll take it back to the lab and test it for two kinds of antibiotics.
I'm looking at Bactrim,
often used to treat urinary tract infections.
I'm also looking at ofloxacin,
a treatment for bronchitis and pneumonia. Franklin and Professor Jack Watson want to know what will happen if those antibiotics come in contact with bacteria in the environment. They wonder if it could be contributing to a major public health problem, bacteria that have developed resistance to popular antibiotics.
What's going on with microorganisms that we don't want to thrive in our bodies? And are we creating scenarios in which some of those are resistant to antibiotics because they've been exposed to antibiotics for a period of time in a natural environment?
Franklin and Watson are several years away from finding out, and they're just one of many teams of scientists around the world asking these kinds of questions about the long-term effects of drugs in our water systems. So how do drugs get there in the first place? Well, sometimes people flush their unused medicines down the toilet. Also, traces of many drugs pass right through our bodies and down into sewer pipes and septic systems.
My name is Joe Swanderski, and I'm supervisor for wastewater services and stormwater on campus. I call it the used water department.
The water that Allison Franklin and Professor Watson are sampling starts out here. Brown, smelly water from Penn State sewer pipes is treated to remove nitrogen and phosphorus and chlorinated to keep bacteria at bay. In the end, the water is clear and smells much better. But Swanderski notes, wastewater treatment plants aren't set up to remove pharmaceuticals.
I learned a long time ago in chemistry there are no zeros. You're going to have a little bit of everything.
The question is how much and does it matter? In January, the Environmental Protection Agency published what's considered to be the biggest study on this topic. Biologist Mitch Kostich and his team took samples from 50 large wastewater treatment plants across the U.S. and tested the water for the presence of 56 different drugs. Kostich says the results were reassuring.
If you were drinking half a gallon a day over a course of a lifetime, you wouldn't be consuming enough drug residue that way to get one therapeutic dose out. That's the case for most of the drugs.
And that's just wastewater before it's put back into waterways and treated for drinking. So that's good news, right?
I do find it comforting, but that's not to say that, you know, you could rule out every possibility of any kind of risk.
For instance, a dozen of these drugs were found at levels that could affect fish, bugs, and other aquatic life. Last year, scientists in Sweden found that low levels of an anti-anxiety drug actually changed the behavior of fish.
We can't possibly test every species out there. So it'll always be impossible to completely rule out the possibility of any effect in any organism that way. And we have a similar issue with people.
Kostich adds it would be difficult to study whether traces of drugs in the water have long-term impacts on more vulnerable populations, like children or pregnant women. He says it could also be unethical to test that. Another question scientists are asking is how to keep pharmaceuticals out of the water in the first place. Julie Becker is a public health researcher at the University of the Sciences in Philadelphia. She says one way is to make sure they don't pass through our bodies so easily.
We want to make sure that we absorb more of the drugs, so when we go ahead and eliminate, we are not eliminating as many drugs.
Becker says in Europe, some companies are designing drugs so that the active ingredients stay in our bodies. But that approach could take years. In the meantime, Becker wants us to keep things in perspective. First, our medications can be life-saving. And second,
let me just be very, very clear. The drinking water is safe.
Even so, Penn State researcher Allison Franklin tries not to think about what's in her water.
That's too detailed for me to be sitting there and just thinking about everything I'm taking in. I'm trying to think about the big picture, like long term.
And Franklin likes her drinking water extra filtered.
There we go. Cheers.
For The Pulse, I'm Katie Colinari.
To find out how you should dispose of your unwanted pharmaceuticals, check out our website, whyy.org/thepulse. It's time now for our series, Patient Files, your stories of illness, healing, and coping. In this edition, Michael Downing, a writer with a remarkable tale.
Well, for me, the story always begins with the death of my father when I was 3 years old because it was an inexplicable event. He was 44 years old, apparently healthy. he and my mother were in bed. It was in the middle of the night. And he coughed a couple of times and went into the bathroom and coughed again. My mother walked into the bathroom and found him on the floor, and she knew at that moment he had died. He had what was diagnosed as a massive heart attack, which had a kind of boastful quality about it, as if it took something massive to fell my father. And then about 25 years later, one of my brothers died in precisely the same way that my father died, total heart failure. And it takes one of my sisters starting to put together that story, there may be more of us at risk than we understood. I found out in March of 2004 that I carried a mutation associated with the condition of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is a hardened and enlarged heart. So essentially the heart becomes increasingly inefficient and finally can simply stop, so that the first symptom, I was told, would likely be my sudden death. I wasn't terrified. I wasn't happy. It seemed like incredibly bad luck. And I was offered the option of having installed in my heart an ICD, a cardiodefibrillator. If this gene did actually manifest and give me the symptom of trying to kill me, the defibrillator would shock me back to life. So it sends an electrical signal to the heart, and it does this in a very simple way. It's inserted with an electrical wire through the vena cava and anchored into the heart muscle. They gave me one of these defibrillators. They threaded the electrical wire through my vena cava. They stuck the thing in my heart. And 6 weeks later, I felt an articulation of pain through my vena cava. And when I took off my shirt, I saw that there were red lines protruding from the area I used to know as my heart. It turned out that along with my ICD, the hospital had given me staph. The only way to deal with the profound infection that I had by then, which was brewing in my chest, literally bubbling, I could feel the active infection when I put my hand across my heart, was for them to perform an explant surgery. I'd never heard of that before. And I actually took out my date book in the doctor's office as if we were going to schedule this. And he said, we're going to do it now. They rushed me into emergency surgery because they thought I probably had a couple of hours to live. So this device that had been given to me to prevent my sudden death was about to cause my sudden death and had to be removed. So now they have saved my life and left me at risk of sudden death. And then it takes 4 months to clear out that infection. In December of that year, they implanted a second ICD. The one innovation was a new generation of these wires that they insert through your vena cava into your heart, and all was well. Then 1 year later, I discover by reading the Wall Street Journal that that new wire that's been threaded into my heart is subject to a recall because it tends to fail. That is, it frays in the vena cava. I finally convince the hospital to remove that device and put in a new device. That's a double surgery, an explant and implant surgery in the same day. That's the last of the major surgeries I had. It has never fired. I have never required it. And with every passing year, I'm told, it becomes more and more unlikely that I will need it. You know, I'm kind of fond of the heart. Mine has been reliable so far. It's done well by me. It's done everything I've asked it, which I can say of very few people in my life, for instance, you know, so it's been a rather good companion.
Michael Downing explaining a frustrating set of medical encounters related to a genetic condition called sudden death syndrome. Ari Daniel produced this piece. Coming up on The Pulse, mycologist Paul Stamets, known by many simply as the man when it comes to mushrooms. He'll introduce us to the somewhat secret world of fungi.
They're literally underneath every footstep that you take. They can be more than 6 miles of mycelium in a cubic inch of soil.
That's next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. Our next guest is a rock star in his field, and he came to our studio carrying a big backpack, and in it was a huge 40-pound mushroom called agaricon.
It's really, really hard. It sounds like wood, feels like wood. It's the longest-living mushroom in the world. Grows up to 100 years of age. It travels with me. It's my best buddy. My name is Paul Stamets. I'm a research mycologist from Comilche Point, Washington. And I study primarily mushrooms and their role in the ecosystems.
Paul Stamets first fell in love with mushrooms in his mother's yard, where giant puffball mushrooms would sprout up after heavy rainfalls. He was attracted to their transient nature.
They come up very, very quickly, and most mushrooms disappear in about 5 days. And to find something that can feed you, that can kill you, that can send you on a spiritual journey, or that can heal you, something so potent and yet so ephemeral, people naturally fear that which they don't understand. And so there's been a lag in our public understanding of mushrooms as a result.
Stamets has devoted his entire career to better understanding fungi, and he's a tireless mushroom ambassador, explaining what fungi do for the planet and making a case that they could be used to correct many of the problems that ail us. Before we got into all that, I asked him to define what a mushroom is.
Well, the scientific definition of a mushroom is a fungus that reproduces spores with a fleshy structure. Basically, if you can see it and feel it, and it's fleshy, it's a fungus, then it's a mushroom-forming fungus. There's about 14,000 species we've identified so far, but DNA analysis suggests there's more than 150,000 species out there. So by that calculation, we've identified really less than 10% of the mushrooms that are resident in the ecosystem. Some of these mushrooms come up annually, like chanterelles and porcinis and matsutake. But many of these mushrooms remain resident, hidden in the ecosystem for decades, and may only appear, you know, once in a blue moon.
And many fungi we can't see at all.
Yeah, the majority of fungi tend to be microscopic fungi. They don't produce fruit bodies, is what the scientific term. Mushrooms are like the fruit of the fungus, like an apple is the fruit of a tree. And the pushed analogy is that the mycelium is the root-like structure that gives rise to the fruit body of the mushrooms, just like a tree has roots and gives rise to a fruit body. And fungi are the foundation of the food web. 70% of the microbes in soil are fungi.
What is the role of fungi on our planet? What do they do?
All plants are part fungi. People don't realize this, is that 90% of all plants are infused with endophytic fungi that grow inside the plants to give it a host defensive resistance against pathogens and disease. There are the mycorrhizal fungi that extends the root zones literally thousands of times. And so plants that have fungi in the roots are able to usurp nutrients, minerals in particular, and they're rewarded with sugars. And so then the saprophytic fungi are breaking down the wood debris. So when you look at the ecosystems, they're really fungally based. Fungi permeate all ecosystems. And people say, I don't like eating fungi. Well, stop eating plants, because all plants are part fungi, you know.
Is part of the job of mushrooms, of fungi, to break things down?
Right. They're the molecular decomposers of nature. They break down plant and animal material, and they dismantle them. This is going to show my age a little bit, but they're like little Pac-Mans that go around the ecosystem. They break down big organic molecules.
You did a very, very popular TED Talk in which you talked about ways mushrooms can help save the world.
I talked about the fact these mushrooms can gobble up bacteria. And we have an EPA grant that and a paper that we've published showing that mushrooms are selective in breaking down E. coli and also staph bacteria. Mushrooms also break down hydrocarbon-based pollutants, which includes oil slicks, petroleum spills, most herbicides, and insecticides. So they're very, very good in doing that. And because mushrooms unify with so many different plant communities, we can design mycological landscapes, customize to the specific concerns of any community. So if you had a toxic waste spill, we have mushrooms that we can match to that. I've invented several different technologies, mycotechnologies, to break down oil. And I created myco booms that can be floating in water that will break down oil slicks. So we're you know, doing lots of different things. And I published two papers on the novel antiviral properties of mushrooms and the novel antimicrobial properties of mushrooms. They had very potent antiviral activities that had not yet been explored. We have a treasure trove of new pharmaceutical agents, potentially. And the CDC contacted us specifically because, I don't know how else to say it other than saying they're freaked out by drug-resistant strains of pathogens evolving in hospitals. There's no very new good antibiotics on the horizon. And what agarikon and these other mushrooms offer is a complexity of antiviral and antimicrobial compounds. So it's much more expansive than people realize. I mean, they're literally underneath every footstep that you take. They can be more than 6 miles of mycelium in a cubic inch of soil. These are extremely fine threads. And anybody listening now, just go outside, find an old log, tip it over. There's mycelium everywhere.
Paul Stamets is a mycologist and author. His website is fungi.com. We're going to stick with the theme of microorganisms for a moment, this time in the context of alcohol. How does fermentation work again?
As I understand it, you throw some yeast and some sugar together, and the yeast eats the sugar, and it makes delicious, delicious things.
Yeah, there are little yeasties going to work, I'm sure.
I know that there's something anaerobic.
A bit cloudy on that issue. At a recent Science on Tap event in Philadelphia, people gathered to hear Adam Zolkover, a food blogger, explain the biochemical event known as fermentation. Pulse contributor Larry Roebling asked Zolkover to explain.
Fermentation is a process by which cells that don't have access to oxygen create energy for themselves. And the byproduct of that energy is, in the case of some kinds of bacteria, lactic acid. And in the case of other kinds of bacteria, it's alcohol and carbon dioxide.
In layman's terms, please?
Basically, what's happening is that the little bacteria are eating, and then we are eating those little bacteria's waste.
Yep, you heard it here. The deliciousness in wine, beer, bread, and cheese, it's essentially poop.
And it tastes great. We select for certain kinds of microbes that are particularly advantageous to us. In the 18th century, fermentation was a key part of long sea voyages because in the absence of refrigeration, you had to do something to stave off scurvy. Bread is a fermented product. Beer and wine are both fermented products. Cheeses are fermented. Kefir, which is a hot health trend right now. Kombucha, which is even hotter. All fermented products.
Kefir, a yogurt-like beverage, and kombucha, a fermented tea, may be trendy today, but Zolkover notes there are references to fermentation 4,000 years ago in the Epic of Gilgamesh, and fermented products are enjoyed around the globe. So how did man figure out that invisible living cells in the air would start this chemical reaction that preserves food and yields pleasures such as alcoholic beverages?
Sometimes I think it's remarkable, and sometimes I think it's a product of desperation, that if you're hungry and it's winter and there's two cabbages left at the bottom of your barrel, you're going to eat those cabbages, whether they look like fresh, nice cabbage or whether they look like, well, sauerkraut.
You would think that after all this time, fermentation would have evolved some modernist technique. But from sauerkraut in Germany to kimchi in Korea, it remains a simple formula. Vegetables, water, salt, and thyme. Chefs have embraced its new popularity and are using it to add flavor, texture, and interest to their menus.
The process of it allows us as chefs to take something that might be very sort of pedestrian and with a little bit of time and a little bit of salt and a little bit of patience, we get something that we can really uniquely use in our menu.
That's executive chef Eli Kalp of Fork and High Street in Philadelphia. He's been using fermentation in his kitchen for over 10 years. In his menu, as well as regular series of fermentation dinners, he explores dishes from the common to the exotic.
We do a cream cheese that is a fermentation process. We make our own vinegars. And then we do things more advanced like cashew cheese, but it's also called Rejuvelac. Rejuvelac is taking the water of a soaked grain that creates an enzymatic reaction with the warm water and then aging that like a cheese. And what that does is really gives like an acidic sort of really savory flavor to the nuts.
Culp sees no produce out of bounds and will ferment just about anything to see what happens. This trial and error often yields the perfect accent for a dish such as his parsley and scallops.
The scallops are naturally sweet, they're raw, they're creamy, so this sort of like slight abrasiveness of the acidity and the texture of that partially broken down parsley really goes nicely with it.
While Culp uses wild fermentation, a process using microbes occurring naturally in the air, as well as purchasing cultured starters, he notes both are attributed with health qualities and fill our guts not only with deliciousness, but also the good bacteria we need. Back at Science on Tap, Zolkover says wild fermentation with a seasoned brine is easy to do at home, much easier than pickling with vinegar.
What I would suggest is not pickled cucumbers. Pickled cucumbers have a tendency to go soft if you don't watch them carefully. The best place to start is probably with white turnips. You just need a quart of water and 2 tablespoons of sea salt. You slice up the turnips, you put them in a jar, you add your flavoring, you pour the brine over, and you leave it for about a week.
So next time you tuck into that wine and cheese or brewski with a burger and pickle, know that you have biochemistry to thank. For The Pulse, I'm Larry Roebling.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, our associate producer, Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast at whyy.org/thepulse. And we really enjoy hearing from you, so keep emailing us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.